नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय If you want to know the place where I always reside, it is wherever and whenever my devotees come together to chant my names and glories. I am always in that place. This means that wherever we come together, we are in the presence of God. When we are coming for the specific purpose of hearing and chanting His infinite glories. It is described that Lord Sri Krishna, he never steps one foot out of Vrindavan. And it is also explained that he is present wherever his devotees are coming together to chant his glories. So what does that mean? That means Vrindavan is not some place you have to take a train or plane to attain. But tonight, right here in this very house of Shyam Kasak and his good wife, because they have so kindly invited us all to share one another's devotion, to inspire and enliven one another's spiritual consciousness, by chanting the holy names, by hearing the topics of the Supreme Lord, and by taking Krishna Prasad, we can understand by Krishna's own words that he is here in this room tonight, in his full opulence, with all of his glory. We can understand that this place is not in this material world, that we are sitting in Vaikuntha. We are in Vrindavan, the spiritual world. Vaikuntha means that place where there is no anxieties. In fact, to the degree individually we absorb our consciousness in hearing the message of the Lord and in calling out his holy names, to that degree you will be able to perceive the place you are in, Vrindavan. To that degree, you will see how you are in the spiritual world, that place where there is no anxieties. There is eternal life full of bliss and knowledge. That transcendental atmosphere is invoked whenever we come together to hear and chant the glories of the Lord. Munaya sadu prishtoham bhavad birloka mangalam yat kripa krishna samprasno yenatma suprasidati. In the Srimad Bhagavat, Shaunaka Rishi asks Srila Suta Goswami on behalf of the sages of Naimasaranya, of all the spiritual and religious literatures throughout the world, what is the essence, what is the most important thing to understand? And following that question, there was a series of important and significant questions asked by the sages. And Suta Goswami replied in this way. He said, your questions are glorious because your questions are inquiring into the nature of God. And the answers to these questions involve the great devotion of the Lord's devotees and the activities when God comes to earth. Therefore, the answers to your questions are meant for the supreme ultimate welfare of all humanity. Many of us are interested in welfare work. There are many types of welfare work. There are many types of charity. Feeding the poor is a very noble effort of charity. Clothing the poor, healing the sick, these are all very important and essential parts of life. Humanity which is based on civilized thinking, means that we must be compassionate. What we have should be shared with those who don't have. That is called the mode of goodness. But the supreme welfare is to enlighten a person's soul through the sound vibration of the names and the glories of God. And therefore, that great incarnation, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he has given an order to everyone who has taken birth in India. Bharat bhumi te lohoi manusya janma jar janma saratakari kara para upakar. He explains that every living entity throughout the creation is the child of God. Aham bija pratapita. Krishna declares in Gita, he is the father of all living beings. And therefore it is the prime duty of every human being to revive one's eternal relationship with the Supreme. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explained that in this land of Bharatvarsha, which is today called India, this is the holy land, which is the place the Lord has repeatedly come again and again and again to manifest his lila. It is like the heart of the spiritual culture of the world. And because the culture of India is so spiritually surcharged with the Lord's appearances, and with the appearances of so many great saints and sages and sadhus and acharyas, therefore, he says, it is the first and foremost duty of every person born in India that they must perform the greatest welfare service for the whole world. By in their life, spreading the glories of the Lord through the process of hearing and chanting. This is the greatest charity. To heal a man's soul so that person never has to take birth again in this world. But then it is said, physician, heal thyself. Unless we enlighten our own souls, what can we do for another? Prahlad Maharaj explains that this is a world where the blind are leading the blind. And what happens when the blind lead the blind? They both fall in the ditch together. We have many universities. I myself, in America, my principal service is giving lectures in universities. And sometimes also in India, I am invited. And we have seen that the faculty members, the administration, the professors, and the students take so very seriously a variety of subject matters and how essential and important it is for them to learn. But I have not seen a single university that seriously teaches the goal of life. Who is God and how to remember him at all times? How to find the eternal peace that is dormant within us. With all the sophisticated educational facilities, we are creating hell out of this earth. And that is a fact. Knowledge is power. Misdirected knowledge is the most powerful agent which leads to destruction. But knowledge which is directed in the pursuit of truth, that knowledge has the greatest power of healing, the greatest power to create peace, prosperity, and enlightenment. within society. So there is no need to disregard or to relinquish the types of education that we have today. But we must give an understanding of the truth so we can perform our duty in pursuance of truth. And in this way, we can actually help ourselves and help others. Our Guru Maharaj explained that the educational systems of today are spiritual slaughterhouses. They are simply teaching the children that learn this, make money, have a nice family. The goal of life is material prosperity. In the universities of America, 90% of what the children learn are greed, lust, intoxication, and all sorts of other vices. I was a student myself. Many of us were living in small towns, and really we didn't have too much exposure to too many immoral and indecent things. But then when you get shipped off to the university and you're on your own, my God, there's a whole world of sinful life just crying out for you to enjoy. And today, you would not believe what goes on. When I give lectures at colleges, I usually spend the night at those places. And on weekends, it is impossible to sleep. It's like Ravana's palace. Practically every student is totally intoxicated on strong liquors and drugs. And practically every man is hunting for a woman and every woman is hunting for a man. And they're just screaming and yelling with their arms around each other, and all they do is get intoxicated and have sex all night long with blaring demoniac music coming out of the speakers of every house. I'm not exaggerating. And these children are learning very, very sophisticated sciences. They're getting great power in the form of material knowledge. Now, what do you think they're going to do with their knowledge? They're going to use it for greed, for lust, for anger, for envy, and all these vices. What this world needs is not more technology. This world does not need more money. It doesn't need more food. There's plenty food. There's only one thing this new world is shortage. There is a shortage of mercy, of compassion, and of love. Everything else is there. But in the absence of love, there's greed. And therefore, when you read the papers, you find all that's going on is violence, which is based on greed. And greed is based on ignorance. Because the truth is, Bhoktaram jagatam tapasam sarva loka maheshwaram suhridam sarva bhutanam gyatvam amshati mrichchati. That everything is the property of God. What do we have to be greedy about? Our nature is to render service to God with whatever we have. It is all His. So this is the greatest calamity within our society. A lack of God consciousness. And this God consciousness is so easily awakened. It is within us. It is our nature to know God, to love God, to be the compassionate brother and sister of all living beings. But we must seriously take to the process of hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord in the association of saintly persons. And then this nature within us is easily revealed. There was one great Vaishnav poet, his name was Narottam Das Thakur. And he explains in one of his beautiful poems that I have seen and considered this whole world. I have been up and I have been down. I have been a success and a failure. I have had everything and nothing. I've been observing and watching throughout my life. And my conclusion is, my Lord, without you, there's nothing that can save me. Without you, my Lord, there is no other shelter. Therefore, Narottam Das Thakur is not praying for money. He's not praying for good health. He's not praying for a beautiful wife. He's not even praying for liberation, what to speak of respectability and prestige. He is only praying that let me forever be your servant. Let me forever remember you and take shelter of you. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is a beautiful story which explains how a particular great devotee was put through very, very extraordinary experiences in life. And then it explains the conclusion or the realization he attained through all these experiences. This story is found in the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavat. It is told by Suta Goswami to Shonaka Rishi. He explains that there was once a young Brahmin man who, with the permission of his father, accepted initiation from his spiritual master. He took the sacred thread, and then on the order of his guru, he went to a holy place in the Himalayas to perform very, very great spiritual discipline. He put on the most simple clothing, the bark of trees and the deer skin. And he took a begging pot to hold his water. And it is explained that he went out every day and he would beg food for his guru. And with all humility, he would come back and give all food to his guru. And if his guru called him to eat, he would eat. And if his guru did not call him to eat, he would gratefully fast on that day. In this way, by the mercy of his guru, he learned how to control his senses. And then he went to the banks of the holy river, the Pushpabhadra, near the great mountain Chitra. And he performed complete celibacy. And in meditation, he controlled his life affairs, and he constantly fixed his attention on the presence of Lord Vishnu within his heart. In this way, he was attaining greater and greater and greater spiritual power. Now, you know, people who have much to lose. People who have nothing to lose. So, generally we find the more a person has, the more a person is fearful of losing what he has. Just like sometimes we find rich people, my God, how fearful. They have walls around their houses and barbed wire fences and electrical computerized devices for security, and they have guards, and they have intercom systems for security, and still they're afraid. Somebody's going to try to take what I have. But the poor man on the street, well, he just lays there, nothing to lose. Who's going to bother me? So although wealth has its place in life, sometimes if we do not have the right consciousness, the more we have, the more we fear, because the more we could lose. So of everyone within this universe, the person who is one of the wealthiest of all men, just like in America we have Fortune magazine. Huh? You have something like that here in India? Some business magazine. And every year in Fortune magazine it has the 10 wealthiest men in the world. And it explains who they are and how they made their money and how much they're worth. And usually these are the 10 most miserable men on earth too. But anyways, of the 10 wealthiest men in the universe, one of such men is called Indra. He's the king of heaven. He has a wonderful kingdom that cannot even be imagined. Even the greatest, the people like the Rockefellers and the DuPonts and the Rothschilds, they think they're rich, but compared to Indra, they are like beggars in the street. So Indra, he is always very fearful, because by mystic yoga, he knows people develop great power. And he's always careful to watch the mystic yogis, because if they get too powerful, he's always thinking that they're going to come and try to take over my wealth and my beautiful maidservants and everything else. I cannot lose them. So he's always very careful. So he heard the news of this great Markandeya Rishi performing the tapasya at Pushpabhadra. So he sent Kamadev, Cupid, and he sent a whole array of heavenly girls and all of his other secret agents and told him, somehow or other, by any means, it is your order to make this saint fall from his tapasya. So they came. And they created such an environment. From all the trees, every leaf and every branch was blossoming with fragrant flowers. It was just at the time of the setting of the sun. And the temperature was just perfect, with fragrant breezes everywhere and chirping of sweet birds and beautiful heavenly apsaras began to sing with such delightful voices that it would conquer anyone's mind, and beautiful dancing girls were dancing in front of him. And one such beautiful apsara, as she was dancing, she was playing with a ball. And she kept looking at this great sage. And then a wind came and took her sari into the air. And then Cupid was thinking, aha, now this sage is conquered. So he took his bow and arrow. And his arrows are full, what the materialists call love, and what the transcendentalists call lust. Huh? What is the difference between love and lust? In the material world, nobody knows the difference. In the material world, people are thinking, lust is love. I love you. In the movies, we see people fall in love. And in society, in the nation where I'm from, so many people are falling in love. And then they get married. And the federal statistic is, 66% of such marriages end in divorce within the first 3 years. What does that mean? They love each other. That means I want to exploit you for my senses, and you want to exploit you for your senses, and that agreement is called love. So they exploit each other for sense gratification, and after some time they get tired of each other, and then they become worse enemies. Huh? First they're, the standard tradition in America is you're parked in a lonely place in your car and you're looking in each other's eyes saying, I love you. And then within 3 years later, you're in the courtroom looking at each other's eyes saying, I hate you. It's called divorce court. It's one of the most popular places in America. Huh? Recently, I performed a funeral ceremony in America. And after the funeral ceremony, somebody said, can you perform my wedding ceremony too? I really appreciated how you did everything. I said, I do not perform wedding ceremonies in America. They said, why not? I said, I'm not a priest like that. They said, well, you performed a funeral ceremony. I said, yes, I know. But you see, at the time of a funeral, when I do the ceremony for that person who's dead, he cannot change his mind. I know that this ritual that I'm performing, the vow that is taken, is final. But wedding ceremonies, there's a 66% chance that you're going to change your mind. So, that person decided to find another priest. And this is called love. Krishna says in Gita that so-called love in this material world is simply the other side of hate. You see, there are dualities. This material world is constructed by dualities. It's like a coin. If you have a coin, you have heads and tails. You call it heads and tails in India? In America, one side is heads, one side is tails. Do you like this with Pisces also? So, if you want the heads, you take the tails, whether you like it or not. So similarly, everything in this material world is like a coin with a flip side. If you want the pleasures of this world, you must take the pain. If you want the honor, you must take the dishonor. If you want the happiness, you must take the distress. Huh? If you want the love, then you must accept the hate. In America, murder is considered the family crime. There's more murders amongst loved ones than there are amongst mafia and drug dealers and everybody else that are so publicly known. Frustrated love creates great envy and hate. So this is not love, this is lust. The propensity for affection within our heart, which is the very nature of the soul, the nature of the soul is to love. When that nature, when that energy within us is directed toward God, that is love. But when it is directed toward the objects of our senses, that is called lust. Love and lust is the same energy. One is directed toward the truth and one is directed toward the temporary illusions of this world. Now, the demigod who is in charge of this lust is Kamadev. And when he shoots his arrow in your heart, it's very painful. Although, you think it's very pleasing. So he shot his arrow with all his might in the heart of Markandeya Rishi. And Markandeya Rishi just sat completely fixed in meditation on the Lord in his heart. And all the apsaras and all the heavenly divine beings who were surrounding him, including Cupid himself, they felt that his devotion and his tapasya was so great, it was causing such heat in their own bodies that they were about to be burned alive. So they all just ran away in great fear. And when Indra heard this news, he became very astonished. At that time, because of the great devotion of this great Markandeya Rishi, the Lord himself appeared before him. In that munificent incarnation of Nara Narayan Rishi. Nara Narayan is an incarnation that comes in two forms. One appeared before him with a beautiful, beautiful white complexion. And the other had a complexion which was dark, blue, like the Tamil tree, or like the monsoon cloud. In fact, Krishna and Arjuna are none other than that Nara and Narayan. And they appeared before him with a glowing effulgence, lighting up all directions. And Markandeya Rishi, seeing the beauty of the Lord, with tears in his eyes, his hair standing on end in great ecstasy, began to offer his obeisances, his pranams, again and again and again. And then he began to offer beautiful prayers to the Lord, that, my dear Lord, you are the source of all life. It is from you that the vital air of life comes about. And even the greatest of all the demigods, like Brahma and Shiva, are constantly aspiring to have your darshan. And you are so kind that you are appearing before me today. How may I serve you, my Lord? And Nara Narayan Rishi began to speak. Lord Narayan said, my dear Markandeya, you have given your life and devotion to me, therefore I have come to fulfill all of your desires. I want to offer you any benediction that you have a desire for. Ask anything of me and I will provide it. Let me fulfill all of your desires. And the great sadhu, he replied, my Lord, there is nothing I want. Now I am seeing you. I am first perfectly satisfied just having your divine darshan. But there is one other thing I would like. This whole cosmic manifestation is completely illusioned by your illusory energy. I want to see that illusory energy of yours and how it is working. So Nara Narayan, they looked at him and smiled and said, so be it. And then they went back to Badrikashram, their eternal abode. So then Markandeya, feeling great, very greatly grateful for the Lord's coming, he began to sit in his meditation and he began to meditate in great love on the mercy of Lord Narayan. And just as the sun was setting and darkness was coming in, he heard very, very loud winds coming his way. Thunderous winds. And then everything around him was just blowing in all directions. And then he heard thunder, and he saw lightning in the skies. And he saw huge clouds mobilizing them over his head. And then torrents of rain. The rain was falling so hard that each drop was like a wagon wheel smashing upon your head. And it started raining and raining and raining with such force that the oceans were getting higher and higher and higher. And all the great oceans on earth, they all merged together. And then there was hurricanes blowing the waters in all directions. And due to great waves bashing one way to the next, all the land on earth was covered. And the rain came harder and harder and harder until the sea was going to the sky. And all the heavens and all the sky, the entire universe was filled with the water of devastation. And there was no one left in the entire universe except Markandeya Rishi, who was floating on the surface of that great ocean. And the waves were so powerful that they were bashing him One minute they'd bash him underwater, then they'd bash him up, smashing him to one side, to the next. And then he saw gigantic sea monsters coming to devour him, threatening to eat him as they were fighting and screaming amongst one another. And then hurricane-like winds would start pushing him one way and the next, and then whirlpools would drag him down under the water. He did not know whether he was in the sky, in the water, in the land. He was in complete state of confusion. It is described that he was intensely hungry for food, but there was no food. He was intensely thirsty, but all the water was salty. He came down with deathly illnesses, but there was nothing for him to do, no one to help him. At times, he felt himself dying and just inches from death. And meanwhile, the waves incessantly, perpetually, were just pounding at his fragile body. Freezing cold, scorching heat. And he remained in this position for millions and millions of years. And there was no place for him to take shelter. He was just swimming and swimming and swimming. There was no land. There was nothing. There was no one. Except pitch darkness. And as he was in this very, very difficult condition of life, all of a sudden he saw a beautiful island. And he came to that island, and on that island there was a beautiful banyan tree. And on the northeast side of that banyan tree there was a leaf. And sitting on that banyan tree leaf was the most beautiful, charming baby. This baby had a bluish complexion, and his eyes were shaped like a lotus, and they had the beautiful pinkish color of a lotus. His nose was like the sesame flower, his neck like the swirls of the conch shell. His hair was like the scattered feathers of a crow. And his lotus feet, its nails were refulgent and splendid. Never had he seen anything so beautiful or anyone so beautiful. And simply by seeing the beauty of this child, all of his horrible, horrible anxiety disappeared. And then that child looked at him and smiled. That child was none other than Krishna. And then that child, like a baby, took his graceful hands and put them around his beautiful lotus foot. And he placed the toes of his feet within his mouth. Have you ever seen babies sucking on their toes? It is a very charming sight to see. Why is Krishna sucking on his toes? This is a very philosophical question. And there is an answer to this question. Nothing Krishna does is not with a philosophical reason behind it. You see, great saints and sages throughout history, they have renounced their homes, They have renounced all enjoyment. They have dedicated their bodies, their minds, their words, their very lives in the service of God. For what reason? Just to taste the sweetness of the dust of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Huh? So Krishna was thinking, my devotees, they are doing so much just to taste the dust from my feet. What is it about the dust from my feet that is so wonderful? I have to see for myself. Now, of course, for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Lord of Vaikuntha Narayan, to start putting his feet in his mouth would not look very good to his devotees. So therefore, Krishna took the form of a little baby, because babies are expected to put their feet in their mouth. And taking this form, he began to suck on his toes just to taste the sweetness that his devotees are enjoying. In fact, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came for this very reason. Krishna wanted to taste the sweetness of the love of his devotees and wanted to see what it was about himself that so much attracted his devotees, especially Sri Radharani. So therefore, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in the form of a devotee. Krishna himself appeared in the form of a devotee just to taste the sweetness of loving himself. So the baby was sucking on his toes, and Markandeya Rishi was so charmed by this that he was utterly peaceful and happy in all situations. And then the baby looked at him and smiled and inhaled. And as he inhaled, he pulled Markandeya Rishi into his mouth and into his body. Now Markandeya Rishi was no longer in the ocean of devastation, but he was in this little baby's body. And he looked around and he saw the entire universe. He saw all the planets of the universe, all the demigods who control the universe. He saw all the mountains, all the rivers, all the oceans, all humanity, all species of life right before him in all directions. And he was struck with wonder. And then the baby exhaled. And as he exhaled, Markandeya Rishi went flying out of his mouth. And then again he was cast into the ocean of devastation, and the waves were pounding him, and the hurricanes and the winds and the whirlpools and the sharks and the Timangila fish and the crocodiles were all around him. And then again he saw the island with the banyan tree. And then he saw the baby again. And he loved this baby so much he simply wanted to embrace it. So he came running to this baby to embrace it, and then just when he approached the baby, baby Krishna disappeared. And when baby Krishna disappeared, the whole ocean of devastation disappeared, and Markandeya Rishi was sitting back on the banks of the Pushpabhadra River in the Himalayas at his ashram, and he looked around. It was the same peaceful ashram that he lived and did his studies and his meditation. And he began to think, how wonderful is the illusory energy of the Lord. And at that time he sat and he was thinking about the glory of Krishna. How wonderful is the illusory energy, but how the beauty and the charm of baby Krishna completely pacified him from all the disturbances that he was undergoing. This is the truth. Due to illusion, we are now in the existence. And sometimes the waves of happiness push us up, and sometimes the waves of distress push us down. Right? And to a very great extent, the ways of the ocean are beyond our control. Nobody looks for distress, but they come. Nobody looks for pain, but it comes. It's the nature of this world. But one who fixes his mind on the all-attractive form of Krishna, even while, and at that time Lord Shiva and his wife Rudrani Parvati, they were coming overhead. And Parvati, she looked at Markandeya Rishi and she said, look at how peaceful this man is. He is, when the ocean is without any wind and all the fish are still, there's nothing more calm looking than that. This man, he is like that. How calm, how peaceful. How much he has attained in his meditation on Lord Hari. She said, Lord Shiva, we should go down and give him some benediction. And Lord Shankar said, what benediction can we give him? He has just seen Lord Hari. He is constantly fixed in devotion to Lord Hari. Such devotees, they do not want any benedictions. But association with great saints like this is the most pleasing thing for a self-realized soul and the most important part of life for the conditioned soul. So let us go down simply to get his association. So Lord Shiva came before Markandeya Rishi. But he was absorbed in such samadhi on Lord Hari that he could not understand Lord Shiva was there. So Lord Shankar, by his great mystic power, he entered within the sky of Markandeya Rishi's heart. And there Markandeya Rishi saw the beautiful form of Shankar with his golden hair, his three eyes, and his many arms. And so pleased, he opened his eyes, and Lord Shankar and Parvati were standing before him. And he began to offer his pranams, his obeisances, again and again and again to the lotus feet of Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva told him, I have come for my own pleasure. Because even Vishnu, Brahma, and myself, we worship those who are saintly like yourselves. There is no greater pleasure we have than associating with such pure-hearted, saintly persons as Lord Krishna's devotees. But now that I have come, I want to offer you any benediction you desire. And please know that any benediction you ask from me, you will attain that benediction and it will be infallible. At that time, Markandeya Rishi, he spoke. He said, Lord Shiva, you are so kind that you worship the people you rule over. The Lord of my life, Sri Krishna, Sri Narayan, has granted me his darshan, and now you, the supreme devotee, are also giving me your darshan. I desire nothing. All my desires are fulfilled. But I have one benediction that I will ask from you, since you are insisting. Please grant me this one desire, that for the rest of eternity, I always remember the mercy of Lord Hari. And that every moment of my life be engaged in his loving service. And that for the rest of eternity, I may find no other pleasure in anything else save and except offering my humble service to the devotees of Lord Hari, especially yourself. And when Lord Shiva heard this prayer, he understood that Markandeya Rishi had attained the supreme perfection of life. And he said, yes, this benediction is yours. He said, this body of yours will live for the rest of this creation, and you will never forget Lord Krishna. And you will have the power to enlighten all others in devotion to God. And then Lord Shankar departed. And Markandeya Rishi, he continues to live. Actually, the soul of all of us continues to live. It is eternal. And this same benediction is available to all of us. But we simply have to make our priority in life the service of God. That is the only qualification. Markandeya Rishi had to go through the turmoil for millions of years in the ocean of devastation, experiencing all the hardness of life in that condition. And his realization was the same as that of Narottam Das Thakur. I have seen and considered everything, my Lord, in this world, and my conclusion is, how can I serve you? There is no other shelter but your loving service. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he prayed in the same way. Nadanam na janam na sundarim kavitam vajagadisha kamaye mama janamani janmanishwari bhavatad bhakti rahaitiki twani. My Lord, I do not come to you for wealth. I do not come to you for beautiful women. I do not come to you for prestige, for followers, for disciples. I don't even want liberation. Simply allow me to be your servant and offer my love to you birth after birth after birth. That is my only desire. That is the perfection of life. Only that consciousness gives complete satisfaction to the self. Every other realization is incomplete. It is not difficult. Some people say it is difficult. It may appear difficult. But really, if you are sincere, then Krishna, ananyas chintayanto mam yajana paryupashate, he will preserve what you have and he will carry what you lack. Whatever our qualifications or disqualifications, if we sincerely take shelter of the service of the Lord's devotees, and if we sincerely take shelter of hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord in that association, then God, who is within our heart, he will personally annihilate all the dark clouds of material desires which are causing us pain. And like the shining sun, he will reveal himself from within and bring light and happiness and love to our life. And when our heart is lit up by the sun of Krishna's grace, then we can enlighten the hearts of others. We can do the greatest welfare, the greatest charity for others, our family members, our loved ones, and all others. So let us take our life very seriously. We only have a few years to live in this human life. And we have a perfect opportunity to attain the same realization as Markandeya Rishi by simply making our devotion to God the priority of our life. This world of Maya, this world of illusion, is constantly trying to convince us that you don't have time to take spiritual life very seriously. You have to pay your bills. But what about your bills to God that have been compounding in interest birth after birth after birth due to not paying them.
Mm-hmm.
We're thinking we don't have time. This is the greatest power of Maya. When a human being, human life is specifically meant exclusively for self-realization, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. When a human being thinks that he doesn't have time for spiritual realization, when he makes that a bottom priority and everything else first, that means that that person is under the greatest power and illusion of Maya. Our debt to God must be paid first. After all, everything we have coming from everyone is ultimately coming from Him alone. Huh? So we must make time. And do you think that you will not have time to do everything else in life? All your responsibilities in life will be fully nourished and taken care of if you, in a responsible way, organize your life so that your God consciousness is first. Do not quit your job. Do not give up your family and go to the forest. But every day you should chant the names of God with strict vow, attentively. Every day you should read the literatures of God. We should give up sinful activities. As far as possible, we should seek out with great anxiety genuine sadhus who enlighten us in the science of devotion. We should associate with persons who increase our faith. We should come together like tonight to be enlightened, to hear and chant the glories of the Lord, to put fuel on that spark of faith within us. And with this discipline, whatever we do, we should learn to do it as an offering of love to God. We should take the responsibility of our family, of our business, of our society, of our nation, all as being the humble service we have to God, to Lord Sri Krishna. Anyone can do it. It is the prime, urgent necessity of life. So let us take this very seriously. And then, by the grace of God, we will find that peace, that love that we are all longing for. Thank you very much. Is there any questions? So kindly called us here tonight. Now it is his house. Now what if I decide that I don't like the way these shelves are and I don't like the way the decor is, I'm going to change it all. And I just start tearing everything apart. Huh? What happens? The police come and take me to jail, correct? Why? Because it's not your house, you have no right to do what you want. If you're in his house, you must act the way he wants you to act. Correct? So everything is the property of God. Nothing is yours. To take God's property and not use it according to His will, to claim proprietorship over what belongs to God, means you are a thief. Correct? Now, is stealing sinful? To claim proprietorship over anything that belongs to God is sinful. So in that way, no matter how pious and moral we are, most all of us are very sinful. So why should we be proud at all? Oh, I am a very pious man. I am from a very high birth. Kalo Sudra Sambhave. In Kali Yuga, everyone's low. So we should all be very humble. Nobody born in Kali Yuga has anything to be proud of. still were proud. Now, on a more day-to-day level, the four basic principles of sinful activity, the pillars of sinful activity, which are supporting all other sins, are illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, and eating of meat. Because these four pillars of sinful activities destroy the four pillars of religion, which are truthfulness, cleanliness, mercy, and austerity. Is there any other questions?
Yes. As you have mentioned that those persons who are a materialistic person who doesn't have a spiritual, so to say, knowledge, they are constantly distressed by attending all the material desires as such. They will not get a piece of your mind. Although they will be thinking that I'll be getting peace by doing this activity, by doing that activity, but finally they will not be able to get it. We have seen in our past experience that we constantly go for it, for getting by doing some activity by which we want to get a peace, but we won't get it. Like that way, although our experience is that we are not getting a peace from that activities, yet we don't remember that why we are not getting a peace. Constantly we follow up to get peace by that doing that same activities without thinking that we are not going to get a peace from that activities. Why is it so that we are not able to know that what is the theme of it? Although we are getting an experience that the thing is that we are not going to get a peace from this activity, yet we go on constantly doing the same again and again. What is this, the thing that we are not getting that knowledge, although it is there that we are not going to get it? I just want to know that what is that thing that which is completely diverting ourselves from this kind of self, although our experience is that we are not going to
get it. It's called Maya. Maya means that which is not. It is said that there are three classes of men. One, the intelligent man hears from God through the scriptures and the saintly persons. And based on what he hears, he accepts and lives by that. That is intelligent. A less intelligent man, he just has to see for himself. Even though he hears about the nature of Maya, the nature of the temporary conditions of material life, Krishna says, Dukalayam Ashashvatam, that this material world is a miserable place because everything's temporary. Krishna says, Abramabhuvana loka punaravartanodrina mamupeta tukontaya punarjanmana vidyate. From the highest planet in this material world, Brahma loka, down to the lowest planet, Patala loka, they're all places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. But one who always thinks of me, one who surrenders to me, one who attains my abode, never suffers birth and death again, but attains the supreme happiness. That is the word of God. But yet we're trying to find a happy, peaceful, eternal situation in this world. It's not possible. An intelligent man simply will hear from Krishna, hear from his devotees, and say, all right, Krishna, I surrender. A less intelligent man has to see for himself, and he gets kicked, and he gets crushed, and he gets crunched. Huh? And then he says, all right, Krishna, I give up, I surrender. And then he becomes a purified soul. But a fool, even after hearing, and even after getting kicked and crunched and crushed and battered around by material nature, birth after birth after birth, he still listens to Maya, who says, yes, yes, but give me one more chance. Just one more. Just if you only have this, then it'll be bigger. That is called being a fool. It is said, in English, experience is the best teacher. Have you heard that statement? Yeah? You've heard that? Experience is the best teacher? But do you know the rest of it? See, the nature of everyone is you only quote the part you like. Right? This is why you have to hear the Vedas from a self-realized soul in disciplic succession. Otherwise, people will just quote the part of the scriptures that they like. Like in America, how many Christians? They'll quote one part of the Bible, but when Jesus says, give up sense gratification, they say, ah, no, no, that's not very important. But this part where he says, you know, the spirit is willing, but the weak is flesh, that's the real thing. We can do whatever we want. We can enjoy sins, everything. We just confess, because after all, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. That's one part. But then he says, Jesus says, if you even look at a woman, if you even touch... Nah, that doesn't pertain to me. That's something else. So you see, people like to take one part but omit the part that doesn't suit their senses. So experience is the best teacher. Everyone knows that. But that's only half the sentence. The full sentence is experience is the best teacher, and a fool learns by no other way. Which means an intelligent man simply hears from proper authority and does it. And a fool will not believe and not accept the proper authority. He has to go against it, and he has to be burnt, and then he learns. It's like a child. A child is told by his parents, do not touch the fire, it's hot. Huh? And the child says, but I want to touch it. The parent says, but you're crazy, don't touch it, you'll burn yourself. John says, but I'm going to touch it anyway. What can the parent do? The parent cannot lock the child in a cage all its life. So the child goes and touches the fire, and he burns his hand. He says, I'll never touch it again. The parent says, all right, I told you. Why did you have to go through all this? So that's the foolish child who's learned his lesson. But the most foolish child is the child that touches the fire and burns himself and says, but if I touch it again, then if I touch it from a different side or with a different part of my hand, then it will feel very good. And then he touches it and he gets burnt. And he thinks, ah, again I'm burnt. But this fire, it is such a beautiful thing. There must be some way to touch it. And Maya says, ah, you touched it with the wrong finger. You touched it with the third finger, not the second, the first. All right, I will. It sounds foolish, but that's the life story of every one of us. We're like foolish children trying to enjoy our senses, which is like touching fire. And every time we get burnt, Maya just tells us, just try it a different way, and then it will feel very nice. So therefore, unless we hear from the great self-realized souls, we'll never understand. So why do people do that? Because Maya, the illusory energy, is constantly through our mind and through the propaganda of this Kali Yuga all around us, is trying to convince us that just try one more thing, and you'll be happy. But the saints and God, the sadhus, the scriptures, they are all saying, forget it. Just chant Hare Krishna and be happy. You have your senses, engage them in Krishna's senses, in Krishna's service, and then you will find real happy. Sarva pariva nirbhuktam tatvaratnena nirbhalam rishikena rishikesa sevanam bhaktamuchyate. The same senses which are now causing us bondage and frustration, when they are engaged in the service of God, they liberate the soul and bring us to the highest platform of love. So do not give up your activities. Do not give up your senses, but simply use them in the service of the Lord of the senses, Rishikesh, and then you will find ultimate. Any
other questions? Yes?
You may remind me of one of the old episode of Mahabharata. Drupadi said that to Duryodhana that you are a son of a blind man. And this is for the entire Mahabharata, whatever war is going to take place. This is also one of the reasons because of Mahabharata.
Draupadi was the cause? Is that what you're saying?
That is how the Duryodhana is projected.
That is how Duryodhana projected. So, are you going to believe Duryodhana? Nobody wants to take the blame. Everyone wants to blame someone else, correct? Draupadi was the chaste and faithful wife of the Pandavas. But Duryodhana, he wanted to exploit the property of the Pandavas, which meant their kingdom, their wife, everything. The cause of the war was that Duryodhana was greedy to exploit the property of God. Because the Pandavas were devotees, and they were fully conscious that everything was the property of Krishna, and they wanted to use everything in the service of Krishna. But Duryodhana wanted to take what belonged to Krishna and take what belonged to Krishna's devotees and use it for his own selfish purposes. Does that sound familiar? That's the condition of every one of us to some extent. We're trying to usurp the property of God for our own purposes. That was the cause. The cause was greed. The cause was forgetfulness that Krishna is the proprietor of everything. And therefore, Draupadi was saying that you are coming from a blind father. Blind does not mean physically blind. She's talking about blindness in the sense of ignorance. Duryodhana was the personification of ignorance. Although, from the material point of view, there was hardly anyone more intellectually capable than himself. He was one of the greatest warriors. He was one of the greatest diplomats, one of the greatest politicians. He was a scholar of Vedanta. He had all material qualifications, but he had one disqualification, that he was not willing to be the humble servant of the Lord. He was envious of God and envious of his devotees. And therefore, all of his qualifications, it was like a pot of sweet rice with sand in it. Huh? Therefore, what Draupadi was speaking was the truth. But Duryodhana, like every other person in ignorance in this world, will never admit his own ignorance due to false pride, but will always blame someone else. Huh? A great man is willing to admit his own faults. And a foolish man is always trying to blame everyone else for his own faults. Anyone can do that. Anyone can find faults in others. But only a very great soul can admit his own faults. Correct? Krishna, the Pandavas, they were doing everything they possibly could to avoid that war. But Duryodhana, he would not give them enough land to put a pin through.
Those were his very words. Yes?
As you said, God appears in this land again and again, which is a rocky bhumi. And why is there so much poverty, malnutrition, diseases, compared to other countries where, I mean, our influence is always towards these countries?
Because for one who much is given, much is expected. Just like if you have one child that's 2 years old and one child that's 16 years old. If the child 2 years old behaves very bad, what do you do?
You just
don't do like this, right? But if the child 16 year old does the same thing, let's say the child 2 years old kicks his mother in the face. The mother just says, oh, don't do that. Right? Now what if the 16 year old child kicks the mother in the face? What do you do? The father is very strict because he knows more. So he's more responsible for what he does. India has the highest knowledge of God. And India has been given the highest culture and heritage of spirituality. Therefore, when someone from India commits sinful activities, it will be held against him hundreds and hundreds of times more severely than someone from the Western world, where there's so little information of God given in people's lives. Huh? You know, India used to be the wealthiest country in the world. Just a few hundred years ago. Do you know how America was discovered? Do you know the story? America was discovered by the Europeans because the Europeans knew that the wealthiest country on the entire planet was India. There was more gold, there was more jewels, there was more riches, there was more spices, there was more of everything in abundance than any other place in the world. And the Europeans knew whatever country in Europe had the most immediate access to India, that country would be the most powerful and the most opulent country. So everyone was searching for a shortcut to India. So Christopher Columbus came and said, oh, if we just go this way, because the world is round, because in India, everyone knew the world was round. In the Vedic scriptures 5,000 years ago, Lord Varaha picked up the earth. It was a ball, correct? But in the West, everyone was thinking it's flat. If from Spain you go that way, you'll fall off. And nobody knows what you'll fall into, but you'll just fall into the sky and some dragons will be there and eat you and everything else. Nobody knew. But he said, no. The world is round, it must be. Just see the way the sun is rising and the way it's setting. He said, if I go this way, if I go west, then I'll reach India very fast. And then I'll be able to get all the wealth and all the abundance of jewelry and opulence of India, and I'll bring it back. All the European countries wanted to conquer India because of the great wealth. India was considered the crown jewel of the British Empire. Actually, it's said that most of the wealth of India is now in the British museums today. Huh? So India was the wealthiest country in the world, and the whole world was looking to India, not only for spirituality, but for wealth as well. And Christopher Columbus, on his way to India, somehow or other, he came upon this land, and he thought it was India. Yes, we have arrived in India. And then they saw some people with feathers in their hair, and they said, these are the Indians. That's how they got the name Indians. But actually, they were in America. So America was discovered in search of India as a mistake. Because India started taking to the ways of the West. Sinful, materialistic life. Therefore, God's wrath is most on India than anywhere else. Because the people of India know better. Trying to preach to people in the Western world is like trying to wake a sleeping man who's been in slumber for a long time. But trying to preach in India is like trying to wake a man that's pretending to sleep. Huh? People in India know better. By their very culture, by their very heritage. Prabhupada said, our Guru Maharaj said, in India they're this far from Krishna, but they're running this way. In America they're this far from Krishna, but somehow he's getting some of them to run this way. If someone who has this birthright of the highest spiritual heritage in all the creation does not utilize his human life for the proper purpose, but chases after the sinful ways of other places, then God deals with that person like the 16-year-old child that kicks the mother in the face. You're responsible, you know better, you're still behaving nonsense. India's being slapped by the wrath of God. But of course, when the parent punishes the child, it's not to hurt the child, it's to teach the child a lesson. So the question is, when will we learn? Huh? When will we learn the lesson? Our spiritual master, he saw that the Indians in India are so much mad chasing after the West that it was difficult to preach to the Indians, because they won't accept you unless you come with American technology. So he decided, if I really want to make India Krishna conscious, what I should do is I should go to America and get some Americans to take Krishna consciousness seriously and bring them back and tell them that Krishna consciousness is good. And they'll say, oh, if Americans think it's good, then it must be pretty good. What?
Thank you very much.